This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Tim Gunn became famous for his role as a mentor on the fashion competition series Project Runway. Now he hosts a new fashion competition series called Making the Cut. The entire series, including the recent finale, is now streaming on Amazon Prime Video. Gunn created and co-hosts the show with Heidi Klum, who he also appeared with on Project Runway for over a decade. Making the Cut brought together designers from around the world, flew them to Paris and Tokyo, and challenged them to design runway and street fashion that was eco-conscious and able to fit all body types and gradations of gender. Unlike on Gunn's previous fashion competition shows, these designers were already experienced entrepreneurs. They had to demonstrate they'd be capable of creating a global brand. The winner received a prize of $1 million. Throughout the series, Tim Gunn serves as a mentor to the designers. Earlier in his career, he was a teacher and chair of the fashion design department at Parsons School of Design at the New School. Tim Gunn, welcome back to Fresh Air. It is really just such a pleasure to talk with you again. How are you? You're living in Manhattan, which is the hot spot in the country.
Well, Terry, first of all, I'm so thrilled and honored to be back speaking with you, and thank you so much. I have to tell you, New York is... it's surreal. I mean, it feels quite apocalyptic. I will say this, though. There are fewer sirens at the moment. There are visibly more people out. Not a lot of people, of course, and people are wearing masks, thankfully. But the city feels as though it's picking up again, just slightly.
I know you like being alone. I know you like living alone. Are you going through too much alone now? And if so, how are you dealing with it?
Well, you're quite right. In many ways, this self-isolation appeals to me. But when you feel as though someone has a bayonet in your back, which in fact, metaphorically, they do, it takes a toll. I mean, I'm thankfully fine physically, but psychologically, it's troubling. And it's not just about not being able to interact with people or go to a restaurant, which I did infrequently anyway. But I mean, for me, the greatest soul stirrer that I have is in a state of suspension. That's the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is just across Central Park from my apartment. And I used to haunt those galleries. I was there at least twice a week. And it's really left a void in my life.
What other things have you had to give up? And have you been finding replacement things, replacement routines that give you both a sense of structure and a sense of kind of comfort or equilibrium, equanimity?
Well, I've been doing a kind of life inventory of what's important to me, what isn't, including things that I own. I've been doing a lot of writing, and I've been doing a lot of reading, and I've been engaged in a lot of introspection, and I think that that's good up to a point.
Yes.
And then it can just become tiresome.
It could become damaging. I mean, there's a point where, self-criticism is good and then it gets bad.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I have to say, too, I'm such a lucky person. I have to remind myself of that because you can very easily fall into this trap of self-pitying. And I think, good heavens, I'm so lucky. I have a home. I have resources that will get me through the storm. I have people I care about and who care about me, and I'm very, very, very lucky, and I need to slap myself when I start wallowing in this self-pity.
I'm wondering what you think the meaning of clothes is now, because most of us are at home, and if we're going out, like, we're wearing a mask. It's like, you're not going to look good. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, like exactly.
The mask kind of ruins the look no matter what it is. Most people at home are wearing like sweatpants or pajamas or old jeans. And I'm wondering like what you're wearing now and what is the meaning of clothes? Is the meaning of clothes changing as we're all like self-isolating?
It's been a very interesting experience for me because I've gone through an evolution in these last five and a half weeks, a fashion evolution or a clothing evolution of sorts. And it's helped me to understand a lot of issues that I've talked about in terms of the sorts of things that I observe in other people. And one is, I now understand the comfort trap. I used to bemoan it and say, you know, if you want to dress to feel as though you never got out of bed, don't get out of bed. Well, now I understand. I mean, why should we be self-isolating in clothes that constrain us and constrict us and are not as comfortable as something that's a little looser and more forgiving? However, I will say this. Having been introduced to video conferencing, which was unknown to me until this self-isolation, having been introduced to video conferencing, I've dressed up for it after, say, days of wearing, quite frankly, my pajamas and a robe. And when I got into my normal clothes, a proper shirt, a proper pair of pants, a jacket, I felt as though I was wearing a wetsuit. I felt so tethered, so tied down, and I thought, oh, this is bad. I need to start wearing regular, normal Tim Gunn clothes more often, because that feeling, I understand it. I've worked with women in particular in sort of, won't call it a makeover, I'll call it a make better. And she'll call out from the dressing room, this jacket is too tight. Just come out of the dressing room wearing it. We'll look at it together. And I'll say to her, it's not too tight. It's exactly the size it should be for you. You're used to wearing clothes that are, frankly, too big for you. So I'm understanding people and their fashion foibles a lot better now.
So when you're wearing pajamas and comfortable robes at home, are they beautiful or are they just like no one's going to see them, so they're just whatever?
Well, I wear a t-shirt on top, just a white, plastic white tee, and pajama bottoms, and a cotton robe that's navy, and it's presentable. I mean, I won't leave my apartment. I won't even go to the trash chute at the end of the hall wearing that. So it's a kind of pact that I make with myself. If I'm wearing this, I stay in. I do not open the door. I'm not going down to the first floor to get the mail. So I make a pact with myself that I am not to put myself in a position where I may run into a neighbor. And I'll add, every third day or fourth day, I go out to the grocery store, which is just at the corner, thankfully. And of course, I get dressed for that, but not. I mean, I have worn a sport coat and a tie a couple of times for video conferencing reasons. But usually, I'm dressed the way that I am now. I'm in a turtleneck and a pair of dark wash jeans.
I keep getting emails because I do some shopping online from all these places that are having sales, and I keep thinking, who cares right now about buying clothes? Who knows what season you'd even be shopping for? And it just makes me wonder, like, what's going to happen to, like, clothing retail?
Oh, I know. I consider this the same thing, and it's quite a conundrum. I will say this, though. We know that online shopping is here to stay. I worry about bricks and mortar. But when it comes to purchasing things, I'm exactly like you, Terry. I haven't bought a thing since being shut in because I ask myself, well, what and why? When we get out of this, which we will eventually, we'll have a much better sense of what we want and what we need. Also, part of this inventory that I've been doing has been closet inventory, taking stock of what I wear all the time, what I don't, what I haven't worn for a year or more. And it's resulted in a purge that's been has made me feel physically lighter, actually.
What's it like for you to have a new series about fashion during the pandemic, when if people are going out, they're going out in a very limited way? And mostly, as we've been talking about, they're staying home wearing pajamas or schlumpy clothes.
Well, to be honest with you, Terry, my co-host Heidi Klum and I talked about this when we heard when the show was going to start airing. And we were really concerned about it. And we thought, this seems to be in very egregious bad taste to do this now. And Amazon listened to us and understood and said, you know, this is really a feel-good show. It's uplifting. It's inspiring. And people will want this at this time. People feel shaken. They feel derailed, off-center. And the show is very grounding. And it's a good time to release it. And I thought, they're right. It really is. And the response has been quite phenomenal.
So you became a teacher, but as we talked about in our previous interview, you really hated school.
Oh,
And
yes.
you went to several boarding schools, right?
Yes.
And you ran away from school. I was wondering, like, what was your technique when you ran away? Like, where did you go? Did you slip out a window in the middle of the night, like I see in movies? Like, what
Well,
would you do?
I used to run away and never leave the house. I was extremely good at hiding and at not making a single movement. But
when you say never leave the house, you mean your home or the house that you were living in, the boarding school?
No, the running away began when I was still living at home.
I see. Okay.
And I became very good at it. And then my parents brought in more resources, namely our family dog, who was always able to sniff me out.
Oh my God.
So then I would run away from home and go to Rock Creek Park, which was right behind us. But then the dog would, my mother would come out with the dog on a leash and the dog would find me. Brandy was her name. So then I started running away with the dog, thinking, well, I'll have her with me. But then I realized she'd get hungry, she'd be thirsty. So then I used to run away with water and snacks for her. But at boarding school, I mean, there was only one really dramatic running away, and it was after, I think we talked about this, it was after a suicide attempt, and then I woke up, and I was still there, and I ran away to, this school was on in Connecticut on Long Island Sound, and I ran away to hide in woods next to a beach, and there were police walking up and down the beach, and I was paranoid enough to think that they were looking for me. Maybe they were, maybe they weren't. But then it got dark, so I went back to the school, knocked on the headmaster's door, it was probably about 8 or 9 at night, and just burst into tears and fell to my knees. And he was incredibly kind and wonderful.
What did you say to him?
Well, he had a huge look of relief. The school knew I was missing. And it was what I remember more is what he said to me, and just being very consoling and very... he was a good listener. And he said that my parents had been called and that they were on their way. In some ways, I hate reflecting upon it because it was so painful. At the same time, I was so lucky to have a family that really did care. I mean, I gave them nothing but heartaches and trouble. But they never abandoned me. They never said, okay, you're on your own.
How much do you think feeling marginalized yourself when you were in your teens had to do with being gay and not coming out to anybody and maybe not even coming out to yourself for a while?
Oh, and I didn't come out to myself. You're quite right. I mean, I knew what I wasn't. I knew I wasn't a heterosexual male, but I didn't know what I was. And I had a terrible fear of intimacy, and quite frankly, I won't call it a fear today at age 67. I just accepted it. It's a very matter of fact. I don't have a desire to be intimate with anyone. I have to say that there were people in the hospital where I was as a teen who were there because they were gay. They were there to be fixed. And I felt simultaneously horrified and sad and terrified. I thought, well, that can't be me too. I have enough issues. And I came to terms with this in my very early 20s. And it was extremely liberating. It was at that time probably the happiest I'd felt.
You know, one of the things you told me the last time is that your father worked with J. Edgar Hoover when Hoover was the head of the FBI, and he wrote Hoover's correspondence, he wrote his speeches, he wrote his autobiography, if I remember correctly. And then your mother started the CIA library.
Yes.
So you had parents who helped keep the secrets and then helped store the secrets. And then you had this huge secret from them. And I just kind of put that together recently, thinking about that and thinking about what I wanted to talk with you about, that they couldn't accept your secret. Like, even when your mother knew you were gay because she saw you on TV, you know, like, she would not engage with you and talk about it. Like, it was just, like, off the table. And I thought, like, gee, how does that fit with the whole Hoover thing and the CIA thing? Like, a family that was all about, like, understanding secrets.
That's a very interesting series of thoughts, frankly. Yeah. And my father in particular, by the time I was born, my mother had left her position. But my father, of course, was with Hoover for 26 years. And he was very private and secretive. Did I tell you about him, Dad bringing home the Warren Commission, the report about the Kennedy assassination?
No.
He brought home the Warren Commission before it went to Congress. And I don't know what possessed him, but I think he was just proud to have it, and he told my mother. Well, after dinner, I can hear the water running in the bathtub of my parents' bedroom, and Dad's watching television or something. Mother's gone, and it turns out Mother's in the bathtub with the Warren Commission. So Dad figures this out. He knocks on the door. It's locked. He asks her to open the door. She refuses. He gets an axe and takes the door down.
No.
To get the Warren Commission out of her hands.
Because it was so secret.
Yeah.
And this was the report on the Kennedy assassination. Like,
exactly.
Yeah. Wow. An axe?
Well, in the basement or in the garage. That's a potent memory.
What were you doing when that happened?
Crying. You know, Dad, stop.
Okay, so this is an example of the extremes your father would go to keep the secret.
Keep a secret, exactly.
Yeah. So when confronted with your secret, it's like they didn't want to know, huh?
No. Well, I think my father must have known also. He died before I even took over the fashion department. That would have killed him. But my father's closest friends were all FBI people. They were all bureau people, and they would be at our house every Sunday in the fall watching the football games. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you, Terry, it was the gayest gathering I think I've ever seen anywhere. It just was. I'm confident that Hoover's FBI was just a hotbed of closet cases.
Really? What makes you say this? And it's a lot of speculation that Hoover was gay.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Is that confirmed?
Well, I mean, we do know he was a cross-dresser.
Right. Okay. Well, that's very interesting. my final question to you, a very important one. When you do go out and you wear a mask, what kind of mask do you have? Is it a cloth mask made out of beautiful fabric or one of those just like medical blue and white masks?
It is a medical mask. Quite frankly, given the circumstances, I think the more medical it looks, the better. people have offered to give me fashion masks in capital letters, and I've said, no, thank you. I have what I need, and give that to someone who really needs a mask right now. Also, I don't want to be thinking about how do I tie this fashion mask into what I'm wearing, and I think it's just so much better to wear what you wear, and then you put on the medical mask because it's has a purpose and it's serviceable, and you don't have to be thinking about vanity.
Right, and or making a fashion statement or something.
Yeah.
It has been such a pleasure to talk with you. I can't thank you enough for doing this, and please stay well.
Well, Terry, I want to thank you, and it's just a pleasure speaking with you and a real honor, and I'm such a fan, and the greatest pleasure for me would be when we get through all this pandemic stuff to eventually meet. That would be fantastic.
I would absolutely love that. That would be something to look forward to at the end of this.
So, well, stay safe and be well.
You too.
Thank you.
The entire season of Tim Gunn's new fashion competition series, Making the Cut, is now streaming on Amazon Prime Video. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, has watched many charity specials on broadcast and streaming TV since the coronavirus began affecting our lives. But one in particular, he says, rises above all the others. It was the recent 90th birthday salute to Broadway composer and lyricist Stephen Sondheim, which remains available in its entirety on YouTube. Here's his review.
Nothing I've seen on TV since the pandemic hit has impressed me quite like Take Me to the World, the star-studded 90th birthday salute to Stephen Sondheim. It was shown April 26th, is still available for viewing, and will be for some time. Aimed to raise funds for a favorite charity of his, Artists Striving to End Poverty, Take Me to the World was presented on YouTube and Broadway.com. It began as a technical fiasco, with Stephen Schwartz playing piano from Follies, while the evening's host and producer, Raul Esparza, and others accidentally spoke over the music, trying to make sense of the wayward audio and video feeds.
Yes. Paul, we can see Raul on the screen. Yes, we can see him in the bottom right, left of the screen.
What's happening? It's lagging.
Nothing worked, and the whole thing crashed for more than an hour. But then, the pre-recorded sequences, minus the planned live hosting bits, started rolling out. One sequence after another, sent in by a talented friend, colleague, or admirer of Sondheim and his work. The performances, in total, ran for the length of an average Broadway musical, but were much better than average. As a TV show, it was up close and very personal. These people were singing, for the most part, in isolation, with minimal musical accompaniment. And sometimes, none at all. Unless you count the birds and the nearby stream that could be heard as Mandy Patinkin stood in his spacious backyard and sang an a cappella version of Lesson Number 8, a song from Sunday in the Park with George.
George is afraid. George sees the park. George sees it dying. George too may fade, leaving no mark, just passing through. Just like the people out strolling on Sunday. George looks around, George is alone, no use denying. George is aground, George has outgrown what he can do. George would have liked to see people out strolling on Sunday.
Most people sang to piano tracks recorded for the occasion, and that austerity only added to the emotional weight. The singers ranged from Lin-Manuel Miranda and Neil Patrick Harris to Josh Groban and Kelly O'Hara. Victor Garber and Jason Alexander told stories about Sondheim, but didn't sing. And there were some relative rarities. Brian Stokes Mitchell did a haunting song that had been cut from Assassins, and four singers from a 2017 production of Pacific Overtures did a beautiful rendition of Someone in a Tree, that required them to pretend to look at each other in various quadrants of the screen, Brady Bunch style. It was one of the two most ambitiously visual presentations of the evening, not counting the finale. The other was an all-out dynamic diva moment, splitting the screen three ways to give Christine Baranski, Meryl Streep, and Audra McDonald the chance to take on the ladies who lunch, individually, then collectively.
I'd like to propose a toast.
Each of them wore a comfy bathrobe and had a drink in hand.
I'll drink to that. Here's to the girls who stay smart. Aren't they a gas? Rushing to their classes in optical art. Wishing it would pass. Another long, exhausting day. Another $1,000. A matinee, a Pinter play. Perhaps a piece of Mahler's. I'll drink to that. And one for Mahler.
Here's to the girls who play wife. Aren't they too much?
Yeah.
Keeping house but clutching a copy of Life just to keep in touch.
Ladies Who Lunch is a showstopper from Sondheim's Company, the musical I saw as part of a visiting high school theater group on the first night of my first trip to New York and to Broadway. 50 years later, on the second Monday in March of this year, I saw Company again, this time in previews, with Katrina Lenk playing a female Bobby. She was terrific, by the way. So was the production. But the lights went out on Broadway that Wednesday, and I feel very lucky to have seen it. In between those two Company productions, for me, is a lifetime of lovely Sondheim-related memories. Not only seeing Follies and Sweeney Todd and Sunday in the Park with George, and getting to interview Sondheim on stage a few years ago, but taking my kids to their first Sondheim show, which was Into the Woods, starring Bernadette Peters. On the Sondheim 90th birthday salute, Peters had the final solo number, a cappella like Mandy Patinkin, and sang a song from that musical. It made me cry the first time I saw it in the theater. And watching it on my screen at home, with my kids all grown up with kids of their own, all of us sequestered in our respective homes, it got to me all over again.
Hard to see the light now. Just don't let it go. Things will turn out right now. We can make it so. Someone is on your side. No one is alone. Might be just the perfect song right now.
It is. And the perfect TV show, too.
David Bianculli is editor of the website TV Worth Watching and professor of TV studies at Rowan University. My guest, the celebrated chef Tom Colicchio, is one of the many chefs wondering if their restaurants will survive the COVID-19 pandemic. He's owned and run restaurants across the country for over 20 years. On March 14th, because of the pandemic, he had to close the 5 restaurants he now has in New York and Los Angeles. The 2 he is associated with Vegas have closed as well. He had to lay off over 400 members of his staff. He's also a longtime activist on issues related to the food chain, restaurants, and hunger. In response to the pandemic, he helped form the Independent Restaurant Coalition to lobby Congress for relief for the restaurant industry, which he fears will be decimated by the pandemic. Colicchio has won multiple James Beard Awards. He's also the head judge for Top Chef, the cooking competition show that brings talented chefs together from around the country to compete in cooking challenges. Season 17 is now airing on Bravo. It was shot before the pandemic in LA, highlighting the city's restaurants, markets, chefs, and local cuisine. The competing chefs are given assignments, often using unusual combinations of ingredients, unlikely tools like a machete, and sometimes in challenging locations outside of the kitchen. Tom Colicchio, welcome to Fresh Air. I hope you and your family have been well. How are you?
Thank you, Terry. Thanks for having me. We're doing okay. You know, we live in Brooklyn, and a couple weeks ago, maybe almost a month ago now, we moved out to, we have a little farmhouse out in Long Island, so we moved out here. It's just a little quieter, easier to shop. The boys have a little more room to run around. But for the most part, I guess we're in much better shape than some. But yeah, we're getting through it.
Good.
I guess it also helps that I can cook.
Yeah. You come to my house. Do you know if you'll be able to open your restaurants?
We're trying to figure that out. In fact, you know, I'm having calls with my staff right now. We're trying to figure out the best way to go about it. You know, when we open up, there's going to be a reduction in our seating. So we're looking at a combination of probably three things to open up. And one would be whatever a la carte business is available. Also, to do a combination of cooked food that we'll deliver, and also a version of a CSA where we can use all of our suppliers to create boxes that can go out to our customers as well. So we can put together some of our farmers, our fishermen, our you know, people that produce chicken for us or pork, and just create boxes where there'll be some prep done, but you'll still have to cook at home.
I see. So you're basically talking about changing the nature of your business.
Absolutely, at least for the next year until there's a vaccine, we're going to have to. You know, we're looking at a possibility of maybe 30% of our original business. So we're looking at opening up into a really depressed market, and so we have to figure out how to increase our revenue streams as much as possible.
You seemed kind of down on the idea a little earlier in the epidemic of restaurants doing delivery and takeout. I think you said it was putting employees at risk without really raising enough money to be that helpful for the restaurants who were doing it. Have you changed your mind about that, or are you just thinking of a different time period so the whole game will be changed then?
Right. Early on, when we were in the midst of New York just getting completely overwhelmed, I have a friend of mine who's two friends of mine, by the way, who are ER doctors, and just, you know, hearing from them from time to time, they were in a war. And you know, when you listen to the scientists, and they were, you know, telling everyone, if you possibly can, stay home. And so for me, and this is me personally, and you know, every restaurant sort of, they have to make their own decision based on the situation they're in. But for me, it was, I think, a better choice to keep my employees home. Mm-hmm. Unemployment had kicked in, the federal plus up on unemployment has kicked in. And so for me, the calculation was, I want people to stay home. I want them to stay home with their families. Kids didn't have a school to go to, so daycare wasn't arranged for. And so I just thought it was a safer option, especially when the overwhelming majority of my employees come in on public transportation. And so to ask them to do that and put themselves and their families at jeopardy, I didn't think was a good idea. Now, I think the numbers are starting to come down. I think in a few more weeks, they'll continue to come down. And then I think it may be safer to make a different decision. But again, everything changes day by day, week by week. And I imagine a week by now, I'll probably feel a little more comfortable asking my staff to come in.
Your restaurants are pretty high end, and you're talking about changing them into places that put together the food. And so you'd either get it cooked, or maybe you'd get the ingredients with directions on how to cook it yourself. But what about restaurants, because I know you're so familiar with the restaurant industry, what about restaurants who are lower priced, more, you know, like medium priced, or, you know, diners and delis and places like that? How do you see that part of the restaurant industry changing in the next year or two?
Well, a lot of those small restaurants have already been doing takeout. There's been a trend over the last couple of years to incorporate some sort of home delivery or takeout into even medium-sized restaurants, either through some of the apps that are out there, the Seamless and the DoorDashes of the world. So there has been a move to doing that already, because the competition has become so stiff that you're looking for any way that you can to increase revenue. Some of the problem with those delivery services is that they charge you 30%. And our margins are already slim enough, and so
when you say they charge you, do you mean like you, the restaurant, or me, the consumer?
No, me, the restaurant. They charge us 30% for the privilege of delivering our food, and obviously they're using their technology. So yeah, it's 30%. Our margins aren't that great, and so when you factor that in, you hope to make it up on volume, but I don't know if the volume is going to be enough. And so, everyone's going to have to sort of figure it out. But I think that all businesses are going to have to sort of modify what they do, at least for the next year or so, until we have a vaccine. Because the question really isn't, when can a restaurant open up? I think in New York, I think the guidance now, I think it's around July 15th. I think restaurants are in the third go round in terms of what opens up. But that's not the question. The question isn't when I can open. The question is when the public feels comfortable walking into a restaurant where the bartender is going to have a face mask on and the server is going to have a face mask on. And there's so many touch points. Even opening the door, someone's going to have to come behind it and disinfect it. Sitting down after you finish your meal, everything's going to have to be disinfected. I mean, the smell of disinfectant in a restaurant when you're trying to eat a meal, I just don't know if people are going to feel comfortable doing that. And I suspect that, maybe for the first couple of weeks, just people will feel some sort of solidarity and they want to get out there and help. But I think they're going to grow tired of it. And then, what happens if you're in a restaurant and even if it's semi, crowded, someone coughs? Do you empty out the restaurant? If a worker comes down with COVID, do you have to stop serving? And so there's just too many questions. And I think that the expense of doing sort of distance eating, I think will be, again, another layer of expense that restaurants are not going to be able to cope with. And my biggest fear is that, yes, we get open, and what happens 2 months, 3 months into this? Is that when the restaurants are going to start to close? And so I think there are so many questions that need to be answered right now, and I don't think anyone really has the answer.
Let's talk about the food chain a little bit. The food chain is probably very confused right now. So much food went to restaurants because that's where so many of us ate. But now those restaurants are closed. Is that food getting diverted to supermarkets and small markets? Or what is happening with it?
No, these are all great questions, and in most cases, not. And there's a lot of disruptions right now happening across the supply chain. There are large issues right now, especially with meat producers and meat distributors. We've seen Tyson close plants and Smithfield close plants because workers weren't protected. A lot of the workers got sick. I mean, in one plant alone in South Dakota, Smithfield, 3,600 employees, over 1,000 got sick. And they had to shut the plant down. I believe that plant actually produced 5% of this country's pork. And so, what we have here on a large scale, there's just two different ways to look at it. On a large scale, we have a corporate concentration that is, quite frankly, these companies are monopolies at this point. And they have taken a distribution model and have kind of, stacked it up and concentrated in certain areas. And so our food system is not resilient. Instead of actually spreading that out and having much more, smaller regional producers, we've relied and allowed these companies to buy up the smaller companies and just become really, really big. And so that's one problem on a large scale. So, I mean, there were estimates that 90% of the meat production could be jeopardized. So you have that. And also you have the problem with producers. Certain producers and certain distributors are set up to do certain things. And so if you have a milk distributor that is set up to, purchase milk from a dairy farm, and they are producing milk for, say, institutions, meaning college campuses and hotels. I mean, maybe they produce milk in a 5-gallon container that is, has a plastic bladder in it, and it's set up to put in a dispenser. those all closed. When schools closed and college campuses closed and the hotels all closed down, now you have this distributor set up to do that. They can't turn on a dime and all of a sudden start putting milk into gallon and half gallon containers. There's different labeling involved there. It's a different production line. And so those dairy farmers that were selling into that market, they don't have a market anymore. And so they have to throw out their milk. Same thing that's going on in the meat industry. If you are a farmer and you're growing a pig, well, they want that pig to be 200 pounds because that's the way their production line can accommodate that pig in those various cuts that are a certain size. Now, all of a sudden, that pig hits 200 pounds and those slaughterhouses are closed. That pig has nowhere to go. And these farmers aren't manufacturers. They don't slaughter these animals. They just grow them and they put them on a truck and they bring them to the slaughterhouse. Now, all of a sudden, that slaughterhouse is closed. What do they do with that animal? If they continue to feed it, it just gets too big, especially once it hits 200 pounds, it starts growing very quickly. Number two, they're feeding this animal. And they're feeding this animal and has nowhere to go. So there's a cost that they are incurring. They know they're not going to have a market for it, so they're killing these animals. Hopefully, they're killing them as humanely as possible, but it's not a simple sort of thing to just change that production on a dime. And so that's the large producers.
Let me just interrupt here. I'm just finding it very upsetting hearing all of this because there's people going hungry. There's people who don't have food because they don't have any money to buy it because they've lost their income. There's also people who don't have access to food because their supermarket has run out of what they need. To hear this recitation of all of the food that is being, you know, dumped and all the hogs that are just getting euthanized but not used as the food they were intended for and dying a kind of pointless death, it's all very disturbing. And it leads me to think, like, surely, maybe not with the hogs, but surely with, like, milk that's in the wrong, you know, too big of a container, there must be a way of getting that to the people who really need it because, I mean, there's all these food banks now.
This is a whole distribution problem. Now, here's the big issue, I think. Government should have had a plan ready to go where it's a playbook, they know what to do, they dust it off during a pandemic, and they can figure out a way to move food around. They should have been a way to move food around the country. There should have been a plan for this. And see, this is the problem when you decide that you want to shrink government down to the size that you could, drown it in a bathtub. And that's the old Grover Norquist line. And so, you know, all these years, we keep getting spoon-fed that big government's bad, and we don't want big government, it's too intrusive, and it gets in the way of our freedoms. But, you know, we don't want big government, we want smart government. Smart government that has plans in place. When something like this happens, they know what to do. They don't deny it's happening. They don't sit there and pretend that they're just going to, somehow just it's all going to go away. No, you have a plan to act. And so this is what we need to do. Now, my understanding, there's a couple bills right now that are moving through Congress that are getting support on both sides to actually start moving this food and somehow getting it to where it needs to go. Because you're right, there's a huge demand. I mean, prior to COVID, we had about 38 million Americans using SNAP, our food stamps. Numbers that I'm hearing out of states like Maryland, they're seeing a 71% increase in applications. So if you extrapolate that out throughout the country, we're talking about another 25 million people that will need assistance. Plus the amount of people that are going to food banks that aren't on food stamps or on SNAP. And so we have a major, major problem right now. We have enough food in this country. We produce enough food in this country. We need a plan to divert that food, to get it into where it needs. But this takes planning. This takes an actual understanding of a problem. And unfortunately, right now, I don't think we have the kind of smart government that can actually turn on a dime and put this something like this in place, at least quickly enough. And so, we could do better here. But you have to acknowledge the problem first.
Do you really think that there could be a government plan to fix the supply chain during the pandemic so that food intended to be delivered in bulk to restaurants and schools and institutions of various sorts could be, you know, repackaged in ways so that it could go to supermarkets and be used by consumers who are eating at home instead of in school or in restaurants or wherever? But we don't have anything like that now, but you think there could be a plan like that if government had the will?
Sure. If somebody asked me, I could have had a plan together in 10 minutes. So, mm-hmm. for instance, what I would have said is, okay, restaurant, I'm going to give you 75% of your revenue that you did last year. And we'll break it down per month. And I'm going to give you that money, and you're going to hire your staff back, okay? And you're going to pay your suppliers, and you're going to continue to produce food. Not your menu, but produce food. Because that's a whole distribution model now that we can tap into. We're going to continue to produce food, and you're going to create menus that are, you know, less expensive, that you can actually turn your restaurants into community feeding centers. You can actually, because restaurants process food. So if I get a whole case of chickens in, my butchers break them down. We cut them into portions. We could cook them. We can prepare them. We can get them to the food pantries and food distribution. We had a distribution set up. No one tapped into it. So instead of trying to actually create something new, you just kind of have to go with what you have. What we didn't have was the money flowing through the restaurants to do that. This is a pretty simple solution, and it works because you don't have to go around the system or create something new. You work within the system. And so could you imagine if every restaurant was turned into a community feeding center where you don't have to do thousands of meals. Every restaurant could do 200, 300. And that whole ecosystem of the restaurant, the employees, the suppliers, all of it stays intact. That would have been the best way to do it, and feed a lot of hungry people at the same time.
And how would you envision paying for that?
The government would have to pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're paying unemployment anyway. So the funds are just going to flow through. There's additional money for food. It's what they do when there's a disaster. FEMA comes in. They find someone who can help feed people. They pay them X amount of dollars per meal. And they do that. Now, this is on a much larger scale. But, you know, we're doing this anyway. And then on top of that, if someone had told me to do that and the rent's going to get paid and I'm producing food, my team is working, I could do that for the next year. I don't have to worry about closing my restaurant either, because for the next year, I have a mission, and that is to feed people who need it.
Well, Tom Colicchio, I wish you good luck with figuring out your future and the future of your restaurants. And, you know, I wish good luck to the restaurant industry, which so many of us depend on it for so many reasons. So please stay well. Good health to you and your family. And thank you so much for doing this interview.
Well, thank you very much. You stay safe too.
Tom Colicchio is a chef, restaurateur, and food activist. He's also the head judge on the cooking competition series Top Chef. Season 17 is now underway on Bravo.